Be good.
Oh, hey, hi, hello there, welcome to the program. It's your pal Andrew, and since you're probably here on purpose, I don't need to tell you what the name of the show is, but I'm going to say it anyway because it's kind of like this weird compulsive habit that you must do. It's the Monkey Tooth Podcast. Now, you may be asking yourself, why is it called the Monkey Tooth Podcast? And I'll tell you why. Who gives a shit? That's why. You know what matters? Today, on this show, I got a great guest. His name is Dan Peraro. Now, Dan, you may know from Bizarro Comics. He's an illustrator, an artist. He's also a writer and a thinker and a weirdo and a guy who can convincingly wear a fedora hat at any time of day or night. Didn't wear one for this show, which that's fine. It's fine, Dan. Not upset. You're a good-looking guy, with or without a hat. What am I saying? I'm saying Dan is here. Dan Peraro. It's his second time on this show, and we had a great time. We chatted about philosophy, art, weird shit happening in your brain. It was fun. I hope you like it. And that's all I'm going to say about this, because I want to get right to the show, because it's so much better than me just rambling into this microphone. But before I jump off here, know that there are links in the show notes on my website, mtp.dog. That's right, mtp.dog. You can find all the links to all of Dan's stuff. But I'll say it out loud here now because that's what you're supposed to do. His website is bizarro.com. That's bizarro.com. You can find his blog and you can subscribe to his weekly newsletter, which I highly recommend. It's $5 a month. It's funny. It's got great art in it. You can win stuff. He sells t-shirts. It's great. Go find it. I've got some of his art. I have an oil painting in my house. It's a print, but it's a print of an oil painting that he did that's awesome. Okay, no more of me rambling. Much more of me kind of rambling in between Dan telling you cool shit. Hope you're doing fun and interesting things. Until next time, adios.
Here's a question. I mean, here's just something to consider. You're going to edit this, right? So, like, if the neighborhood dogs start barking like crazy for 3 minutes, we can just wait it out.
Yeah.
Okay. Because, you know, it's Mexico, and everybody's got a fucking dog on their fucking roof, and they bark at every pedestrian that walks by. So, it's, you know, you don't move here for the peace and quiet. That's for damn sure.
No. Mexico's turning you into Joe Pesci.
Is it?
Everybody's got a dog on the fucking roof.
Everybody's got a fucking dog on a fucking roof. Anyway.
You laughing at me? Well, thanks, man, for coming around on this fabulous Monday.
Are we doing this now? Should I be on my best behavior?
No, you should act fucking weird the entire time. Which if that might actually be your best behavior.
Have you started recording?
Oh, yeah. That was that countdown in the beginning.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I'm definitely leaving this in. There's no way I'm editing that out.
Whatever. I got nothing to hide.
Yeah. So we are recording. Sorry. I should probably make that more clear in the beginning.
Check my look.
Your eyebrows are in good shape. We don't have to use the video, but you look cool.
No, I changed shirts, so I hope you do use the video.
I also changed shirts, and we happen to both be wearing like blue. Are you wearing a jean shirt?
Well, no, mine's actually kind of a light gray.
Oh, nice.
That's blue. This is great.
All right.
But yours is light, nice. Light blue, but I noticed that it looks similar, so you got the memo.
It's very similar. You know, it's funny, as I did take off, I had a Pearl Snap shirt on.
Oh.
And I took it off because I know you like to wear Pearl Snap shirts.
You're so right.
I
wanted, this is a Pearl Snap shirt.
Infringe upon your thing.
Yeah. I have a nice, I love this image. Cool. This is from, what's his name, Posada?
Yeah.
Posada, the guy who invented the whole skeleton person thing that you see in Day of the Dead in Mexico.
Yeah.
He's an interesting artist.
How is it in Mexico right now? What's going on?
Well, it's fine. I like it. The weather where we live, the weather's great. Yeah, I mean, we moved here in 2016, if that date rings a bell at all.
It does ring a bell.
Yeah. And it wasn't, you know, we didn't move here for political reasons. I mean, well, that was on the list of things that we were thinking about. I mean, you know, we had other reasons for doing it, but then when somebody got nominated by the Republicans to run for president, we thought, well, there's no chance he'll win, obviously. Yeah. There's no way he'll win. But the fact that one of the major political parties was irresponsible enough to put a guy like that close to the White House, it's time to get the hell out of here. And so we did. And then when he won, it's like, oh, shit, did we make a good decision? So we still feel that way. I mean, it's still, I you know, we have high hopes that America will be able to pull itself back from the cliff that it is dancing on at the moment. I mean, I really, 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 really hope that they do. But if they don't, my wife and I are so glad that we're not there anymore. Not that we have a lot of loved ones who still are. Like you, for instance. We love you.
They love you too, man.
I don't want you to end up in prison as a political prisoner because you admitted
neither
voting for a Democrat.
Right. Although, what was the quote, the Hunter S. Thompson quote? Many great books have been written from prison.
Yeah. Well, so, that's just it.
So Mexico, you know, it's lovely in so many ways, but what, like, the anxiety that people are feeling here, even people on the right, you know, they've got this vision of Joe Biden that's not dissimilar from your vision of Trump. So everybody has this anxiety that, like, the future is at stake. Do you feel that down there? Are you feeling that, like, is there, like, a public journalistic sort of, like, poking of that raw nerve the way we get it here?
That's difficult to say because so I have been here for 7 years. Seven years and a few months. And I don't speak Spanish extremely well. In fact, I didn't speak any Spanish when I came here. And I have been learning it since. And I'm functional in Spanish, but I'm not good enough with Spanish to make close friends with native speakers who don't speak English. So I only know, in terms of, like, actually being friendly and having conversations with, I only know a small handful of Mexicans. And this town I live in has a lot of expats. And so I have a lot of friends who are expats. And they're all very concerned, of course. They obsess about it constantly, obsess about what's happening in the United States politically and culturally. Mexicans, I don't know. I mean, I intentionally don't pay close attention to Mexican news and politics because it's disturbing. Just because politics and news are in general are disturbing. So I'll tell you, when I first moved here, I obsessed on politics. I was the kind of person who was constantly having arguments in my head with Fox News viewers about, you know, and it was torturing me. I mean, it was really torturing me. And I was meditating about it one time. And just, and at the time I had no spiritual beliefs whatsoever, but I was meditating and just looking for some way to relax, you know? And I got this very strong message, which was not something I'm used to getting in meditation. It's not the point of meditation. But I just got this very strong, all of a sudden I got this very strong knowing. You don't control these things. Draw pictures, write stories. That's what you do. And leave the rest of it to the rest of humanity. And so, and the funny thing was, it was like this huge weight lifted off my shoulders. I just thought, what? Yeah, of course. It's not my thing. I'm not a politician. This is not my thing. I am a voter. And so I keep track of highlights. I know headlines. Highlights.
That's a good way to put it.
Highlights, lowlights. Most headlines are more.
The apocalypse. Yeah. The highlight reel of the apocalypse could be another name for the news. Yeah.
Headlines are the dark shadows that the highlights make. So I pay attention enough to know who to vote for and where to send my donations, what kind of things are going on in the world. But I don't obsess on it, and I don't read constantly, and I don't forward all these anti-Trump memes and all the shit that is so common among Americans and other people who are NATO members in general, who are afraid of what's happening to the world order and what's going on in the United States. So, I try to take a larger historical view, and I try to remind myself, this stuff happens everywhere, all the time, always has. We've been living between World War II, well, really kind of between Vietnam and now. We've had this long stretch of relative peace and ease of living. It's one reason that I think Americans are so spoiled, is because it's been so easy for us. And now suddenly we're faced with what the rest of the world puts up with on a daily basis, you know, teetering on the edge of authoritarianism and bad actors and war and tribal, the whole tribalism thing. So I just try to remember that I'm not in charge of these things. I'm just, you know, I have a brief lifespan in the middle of an infinite cosmos, and it's relatively unimportant. And so I'll do what I do. I'll live how I live. What happens, happens, and then I'll be gone. And that's my manner of keeping sort of a peaceful mind and heart during all of this conflict. It's just sort of the mental space that I have decided to live in. It's a decision, because I could easily let this stuff drive me crazy and I could be tremendously fearful. But I also think today is a good day. It's nice out. It's sunny. There's nothing bad happening to me right now. It would be a crime to ruin every good day by worrying about potential bad days that haven't happened yet, or ones that happened in the past and are long gone. It's just a crime. And so that's another way in which I calm myself. It's like, you know what? Today's a nice day. There's nothing bad happening to me today. Be happy for today. Enjoy this day. You owe it to the universe for this gift of a lovely day to appreciate the lovely day and not ruin it by worrying about what's going to happen tomorrow or the next day or in December or in November. So that's where I sit.
Well, thanks for showing up. We can end it right there. Perfect.
The end.
The end. Yeah. Anything that you worry about sucks at least once more than it needed to, you know?
Yeah.
Whatever's going to happen is coming. It's not that you can't be proactive or try shit or do right. different things, but yeah, to just be a mm-hmm. and there's a living in some.
I also think there's a difference between preparing and worrying.
Right.
Preparing for the future is one thing. Worrying about it is a whole nother thing.
Well, we've got these little like bad news delivery nexus things mm-hmm. that live next to our genitals that are always like, I was thinking about this recently about like my great grandmother, mm-hmm. a woman I never met, who was basically kind of a very close mythological figure in my mind.
Oh, really?
And that I got these like very, very intense stories from my uncle. My uncle passed recently. Mm. And I spent 3 days with him recording his life story. And he told me all these things about my family and about, you know, he was 86. So his childhood linked to what seems like the ancient past to me. You know, these people who were born, you know, over 100 years ago, mm-hmm. well over 100 years ago. And him describing these people to me and their lives and what it was like for them, that World War II happened, World War I, II, and Korea and part of Vietnam happened in their lifetime, you know, and then like having to picture her, my great grandmother specifically, showing up in an airport around a bunch of people who dressed like they're in their pajamas. Like, did you notice that like modern people kind of look like pajamas? It's weird. And then everybody in the airport's like this, looking down mm-hmm. right at their phones, their faces are lit up at a thing that's basically giving them bad news and meaningless pictures. Mm-hmm. It just would have been a horror show of dystopian yeah. weirdness.
Yeah.
That you know, she missed out on just by having the good sense to die.
Yeah.
You know, like yeah. that idea of this must pass. This has to go through us. And it's, you know,
yeah.
You either make copies of yourself or you don't. And it just, the whole show snowballs along with or without you. So to what end is it useful to be worried about it?
To none. There's no point
to none.
It does no none. Good. It doesn't do yeah. anyone any good. Not you, not anyone else.
No.
It's just a way. It's just a damn sure way to ruin your life. You know,
or at least ruin a Monday.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of my favorite sayings is the way you spend your day is the way you spend your life. And it's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. If you go to a job you hate all day, thinking that someday you're going to be happy, it's bullshit. You're going to be at that job the rest of your life. That's how you spend your life, is how you spend your day. And if you're worried all day, then you're worried out. You're worried throughout your life. You've got to realize that now is all you ever have. It's just now. It's not then. It's now. And right now,
yeah,
I'm fine.
Right. I'm fine. And what you're doing with your right now specifically is of interest to me, because you just mentioned that those are the three things I'm mostly interested in. One, your writing, your art, which are kind of very similar things, and then your spiritual journey, which has been, a phrase I'm sure you would not have said out loud up until maybe fairly recently. And that your sense of knowing that came in a meditative state.
Yeah.
Which that also sounds like something you would not have said just a few years ago.
Correct.
That it was just, you know, what you draw pictures and write stories. I mean, that's, that to me is, it's a calling. It's noble, but you're not the kind of guy to just tout nobility.
Yeah.
So where do you want to start in that continuum of three things? Writing, art, or your spiritual journey? Maybe we should get the spiritual journey out of the way first and talk about that. Yeah.
Well, in a nutshell, I have always been compelled to create art since I was a toddler. It was my first favorite thing to do was to draw. And I've added many things to it, you know, over the years. I mean, as a kid, I also enjoyed sports. I liked playing outside. I liked make-believe. I liked all kinds of fun things. But going to my room, being by myself and drawing was always the favorite go-to. And I say this with all seriousness, whether it was totally an accident of genes or whether there's some higher consciousness behind it, but somehow I was born with terrific abilities to create art. And when I was a child, I could see art in my mind that I would someday be able to produce, but I didn't have the hand skills yet. It was profoundly frustrating. I was like an adult. As an artist, I was an adult in a child's body, and it drove me nuts. And then as a teenager, I started to be able to create the things I could see in my mind. And of course, I always got a lot of strokes for this, because adults recognized that I had this great talent for art. For me, it was just something that I loved to do and something I was compelled to do. I mean, I really had to do this all the time. Not all day, every day, but not more than a couple of days has ever gone by that I didn't draw something or paint something or work on some kind of art, unless I was traveling and was just unable, you know. I mean, when I was 20 years old, I went to Europe for 4 months and kicked around, and I didn't do a lot of art there. I drew in a sketchbook and stuff, but I didn't really create art. But man, it was so inspiring. I couldn't wait to get home and create art. It's just been a driving force in my life. I'm not happy if I can't do it. And I always just assumed it was when I was a kid, I thought that I was ordained somehow. I was raised a Catholic, and I went Catholic family, Catholic school, and I believed all that stuff. And I was, and I really believed that God had created me, that mythological God I was taught about in Catholic school had created me to do art. And so I did it, whatever. I didn't need to know. I didn't need to believe that, but that's just what I was kind of taught, I guess. And so I was indoctrinated into that kind of world. And then as a teenager, it just didn't make sense anymore. And I stopped believing that. But I was still very curious. I did a lot of reading about world religions and about various spiritual kind of things. And it kind of released me from the mythological dogma that I was raised with, but it didn't really put me on any new track other than, I became an atheist. I mean, at first I was agnostic and thought, well, you can't really know these things. And then I thought, yeah, you can know it. It's bullshit. These characters don't exist in the sky. I mean, come on. That's just not how anything works. What am I thinking? So I dropped all that. By the time I was 21, boom, that was all gone. And it wasn't until I was in my 60s. I mean, for all those years, I was a hardcore Christian ball-busting atheist. And of course, I could see how religion was, where religion in politics in the United States was heading. The Taliban can tell you where religion in the United States was heading in terms of politics. You can't let religion into politics without becoming the fucking Taliban. That's just where it leads. So, I was extremely critical of all that kind of stuff. And never missed an opportunity to make fun of or ridicule people who believed in magical superheroes in the sky. And then I had, shortly after this other thing that I just told you about meditating, I had this bizarre experience. I will tell you this story. It'll make me cry to tell you the story, but that's what you love it when when your interview guests are.
I like it when anybody cries. That's all I ever look for. That's the way I spend my day. Is it just making people cry? So
you don't even have to make me cry. Just ask me to tell this story. So my wife and I, she told me that she had been listening to this guided meditation, and I'd done a lot of meditation by that time, but it was all very scientific. You know, I mean, there was nothing spiritual about meditation, and there doesn't have to be.
Right.
There certainly does not have to be anything spiritual about meditation. Scientists will tell you this is good for your brain. Shutting things down, learning to rest your brain and think of nothing, and all that whole practice is so good for you in so many ways, physically, mentally, so emotionally. So I thought, yeah, cool. I've done guided meditations before. And they're typically like, imagine this, imagine that. You know, imagine a stream of water with a feather floating down the, you know, whatever. Concentrate on your breath, whatever. There's a million ways to do it. So this one was like that. It was just like, imagine. But anyway, at some point, like a minute and a half in, and I was completely sober. I hadn't been drinking or smoking or taking mushrooms or anything. I mean, there was no hallucinogens involved at all. I was just sitting at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the evening with my eyes closed, listening to this guided meditation. And it said, imagine a light at the very top of the universe shining down through you. And bam, I was overwhelmed by this fire hose force of energy and love just racing through me. It was like, and I'm not a person who has experiences like that. I never fucking have. I didn't expect to, and I didn't believe they were real. When people would talk about that, I'm like, oh yeah, you wanted it, you know, psychosomatic, whatever. And who cares what it was? You don't care when you're having it. You don't care where it comes from. It's just overwhelming. And it was just this profound amount of love from some place else. And I began sobbing. And then I began laughing. And then I began sobbing. This was alternating like every 3 seconds. I would like, it was like back and forth. And my wife is like very gently touching my knee going, honey, are you okay? All right, I'm here. Talk about it when you feel like it. Whatever. This went on for like 3, 4, 5 minutes. And the only thing I could say was, what's happening to me? Through the tears and the laughing. I call it laugh sobbing. Through the laughing and the sobbing, all I could say was, what is happening to me? What is happening to me? It's the strangest thing. Anyway, and then I got this profound knowing. Not a voice per se in my ears, but this very profound knowing. And it said, you are not an accident. Be who you are. Know what you know. And I completely immediately understood the "you are not an accident" part, because all my life I had convinced myself I was an accident of biology, as everyone is. There's a 100 billion, you know, there's like millions and millions of sperm and however many thousands of eggs, and whatever happens, happens, and everybody's an accident. And that was just how I had always seen myself. And I was fine with that. It's not like it tortured me. It's not like I was looking for religion. I wasn't. I hated religion. I still kind of do. It wasn't about that at all. It was completely unexpected. It was not a message I expected to get, not a message I wanted, not a message I'd thought about. It just, bam, it was there. Okay, it took me days to recover from this, in a good way. When it was over, I was just profoundly humbled. And I saw myself differently. I saw the world differently. I saw the universe differently. I saw consciousness and existence differently. I just thought, there's something else bigger than us. There just is. I don't know what it is. It's obviously what people call God, but I don't like that word because it just calls to mind mythological gods, which, and that stuff started to fall into place too. It's like the fairy tales we tell kids to teach them things. That's what religions are. That's what mythology is. It's not meant to be taken literally. It is meant as a childlike explanation of things that we can't really understand from here, from this existence, from this human consciousness. It's my belief. I'm not right. I'm not saying I figured out everything. I haven't. And that's the first thing you figure out, is that you don't know and you can't know. All you can do is wonder and feel. And try to understand. Anyway, it really became kind of a fascinating thing. Sometime after that, I did a mushroom trip, a mild mushroom trip. I wasn't even hallucinating. I mean, you know, it was like colors and stuff, but it wasn't like, you know, I was not in another place. But I began, after that incident, I began reading some spiritual stuff, and I came across the writings of Alan Watts, the sort of hippie spiritualist from the 60s. And man, I felt like that was my guru. Man, I fell in love with the way he thinks and writes. And anyway, I got a lot from that. I learned a lot about Buddhism, which I had never bothered to really investigate at all. And other kinds of things. And because of this, I became really curious, and I started doing just experimenting occasionally with mild hallucinogens to see if they would take me to that same place that I went to accidentally during meditation that day. And this is the thing that you immediately discover. You can't turn these things on and off. We are not in control of those things. And occasionally during meditation or during a hallucinogenic trip, I've had little bits of these kinds of revelations, but they're not controllable. It's not something that I can bring about. But one day I was, because my parents were in there, and my parents are still both alive. They're in their 88. And I was just concerned about, you know, saying goodbye to them, never seeing them again, my feelings behind death, like what would, you know, all of the things, just about that, just that basic anxiety about my parents nearing their death. And so I just, during meditation, I mean, during these mushroom, this little fairly mild mushroom trip one day, In the Sunday afternoon on my patio, just looking up at the clouds. And I said, what happens when you die? And bam, I was just taken up into the sky. Not literally like a hallucination, not at all. I was completely still aware that I was sitting in my seat on the patio, looking up at the clouds. But once again, I just got this tremendous knowing. When you die, you return to the stream of consciousness from whence you came. And it is glorious. What you're doing now is the hard part. Dying is easy. And your parents are going to love it. And like it made me feel like I just thought, oh, thank you. That feels good. It was good to know that they will be happy.
Yeah.
I mean, they both think that they're both very strong Catholics, and they think they're just going to close their eyes and wake up in heaven with Jesus. And that's fine. Maybe they fucking will. Maybe that's exactly what is going to happen to them. I have no idea. But to my mind, just the idea that I came from somewhere and I'm going back there. And it's not that I was afraid that I would cease to exist. That doesn't bother me. Still doesn't. I cease to exist every night for 8 hours while I'm asleep, and I don't give a shit. Guess what? It doesn't bother me in the least. As Mark Twain once said, somebody asked him, aren't you afraid of what might, because he was a kind of a public atheist, which was not popular at the time. And someone asked him, aren't you afraid of what might happen after you die? And he very famously said, I was dead for billions of years before I was born, and it didn't inconvenience me in the slightest.
Yes.
And you can't argue with that logic. So no, I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid of my life. It's not like I need to be eternal. I don't. In fact, that seems kind of daunting. But I now feel that consciousness is a much bigger, stranger thing than we realize. And it's why we have so much trouble pinning it down scientifically, is because it's like, it is what's behind this whole illusion of life and earth. And I just, it, like, the whole thing is, it's almost like, I almost feel like this is an amusement park for consciousnesses. Like, let's go be born and spend a few minutes, 85 years being mammals. And you know what, when I think of life this way, when I think, you know, I came here on purpose to experience what it is to be embodied. Walking upstairs is kind of fun. It's like, look at me. I am powering myself into a different place with these meat legs they've given me. It's like there's a way of looking at all of this that really can just sort of make the entire experience much more magical. Even benign, banal, boring bullshit like making coffee in the daytime. It's like, ooh, smell that. I couldn't do that without a nose. That smells good. That's why I came here, to smell coffee. I don't know. It's just kind of where my mind has landed. And then I did a DMT trip, and I'll probably never do it again, because it was fucking mind-blowingly awesome. But it didn't last long. It's like 10, 15 minutes. But I really felt like I walked in a garden with God, and she told me. And that's the thing, assigning a gender to God. In this case, whatever it was presented itself to me as a grandmother. And I was blown away by the awesomeness of the whole DMT thing. And she took my hand and kind of calmed me down. And she goes, it's okay. And I was like, this is too much. She's like, I understand. You're not ready yet. It's okay. You have forever. Just relax. Go back, tell your wife what you saw, and live your life. It's important. Very, like, no judgment, no anything, just very calming, compassionate, and loving. I was like, oh, thanks. And then I just started coming back to my, DMT is so fucking weird, man, because your consciousness leaves your body. And I was warned about, I did it with a therapist. A friend of mine is a therapist who uses hallucinogens to help people with drug addiction. And so she was just kind of sitting with me through it, you know. And she told me beforehand, she says, your consciousness will leave your body, and that can feel disconcerting. Damn, you think? It felt really disconcerting. It was strange. I mean, I'm sure you've probably done these kinds of things, but it's different than just like LSD, where you see hallucinations, but you still know that you're in this world and like that. It's not like that. It's like you go somewhere else. You leave your body and go somewhere else for a short time, and then you come back. It was very strange. But also humbling. I just saw it. I will never again say there is no God. I know that there is no mythological God. There aren't those kinds of gods. Those, like I say, those are fairy tales that we tell ourselves to try to understand things we can't understand. But it's not, but it isn't that. It's, who knows? Who knows? Who knows? It's something else. but it's something. And it's so fucking much bigger than we are that it's indescribable. So that's my spiritual story. It's weird.
I'd say you described it. You at least outlined it pretty well. Maybe you can't describe it, but you did a pretty good job.
Yeah. And the thing that I see, another thing that happened to me before this, all of what I just described to you happened within the last 4 years. About 5 years before that, right before I moved to Mexico, I was working on my Bizarro deadlines. I do a syndicated cartoon strip called Bizarro for listeners who don't know who the hell I am or care. So I do this newspaper cartoon. And so I have to write and draw a cartoon a day, 365 days a year. And I did it for over 30 years, 33 years or so anyway. So I was constantly under deadlines. So I'm working on my deadlines. I'm not thinking about anything. I'm listening to music. I'm singing along and I'm drawing a cartoon for Bizarro and I'm doing my regular thing. And boom, a scene from a story comes to my mind. There's this cowboy. He's racing through the desert. He's got a kid. Somebody's chasing him. I don't know who. I don't know where they're going. I don't know why. But then this thing happens, and he sees a cave, and the horse breaks his leg, and he shoots it. All this stuff happens, and I'm like, okay. So I just wrote it down. I thought, I don't know why. It's a story. There's a story coming through my head. I don't know why. So I wrote it down. And then, like, 2 weeks later, the next scene came to me. And then shortly thereafter, another week or so goes by, and another scene came to me, and I kept writing them down. And eventually I was like, this would make a great graphic novel, but I don't want to write a graphic novel. I don't want to write and draw a graphic novel. That's a years-long process, and I've got other things that I want to do. But anyway, it kept coming to me, and I kept writing it down. And then I put it aside. We decided to move to Mexico. I put it aside, and for like a year, we were just getting used to it. We had the whole 6 months of moving to Mexico. And then once we were here, it was like a year of kind of, you know, regaining our place or whatever you call it, orientation, like reorienting ourselves to the way the world works here. And by that time I had semi-retired the cartoon strip. I hired a colleague of mine to take care of the Monday through Saturday ones. And I was just doing Sunday comics once a week. And so I had more time. And so I thought, well, now I'm going to start painting because it's what I had kind of been all my life. It was like a kid trying to get their homework out of the way so they go outside and play. I always felt like someday I'll get the money-making aspect out of the way and I'll start painting and I'll be the painter that I've always wanted to be. So I spent a year painting and I did a show and I sold some paintings. And then I just kind of, it's not like I ran out of ideas, but I did come against a kind of a wall. And then this thought pops in my head, read that story that you were writing. I'm like, nah, it's a graphic novel. I don't want to read that. And it's like, no, just read it. What are you afraid of? It's on your computer. Pull it up and read it. What can it hurt? So I was like, okay. It's just a conversation I was having with myself, basically. And I read it. I opened it up and I read it. And I'm like, oh shit, I have to finish this. And it became a compulsion. Bam. And I started writing and writing and writing. And I wrote for months and months and months until the story was done. And then I started illustrating it. And that's Peyote Cowboy, which you can find peyotecowboy.net, not com, net, peyotecowboy.net. And that's where I post the illustrations for this graphic novel. And then when I finish it, I'll try to publish it as a book. But for now, it's just online for free. And that has now, in light of what's happened to me in the last 5 years, that's where all of my creative inspiration has been coming from, is this higher consciousness, this mainframe of some sort is pouring stuff through me. And all I'm doing is channeling it. And it really feels that way. I feel like all my life, what I've been doing is channeling stuff from elsewhere. And I'm still not prepared to say where that elsewhere is. All right, now I have to pee. I have to take a break.
Hitting pause.
I mean, that tells you something right there, is that all these years later, I can't tell that story without crying. It still has this kind of fundamental, powerful feeling, it's a deep thing.
Yeah, clearly,
it is
clearly a deep thing.
Yes,
and a gift that it still has that sort of resonance, that like you get aftershocks of it, even, you know, these many years removed, is a real gift.
You know, you look back at, I look back at all the kind of spiritual writings throughout history, and I think it's in the Bible somewhere. It says that faith is a gift, but a lot of this has been said in different ways in many different traditions or whatever. It isn't easy living in this material world. It isn't easy to automatically believe in the immaterial. It is a gift to be able to do it. It's a gift. And you can tell yourself that. You can comfort yourself by saying that there's a God in charge and I can pray and ask him for things or for help or whatever. The whole gender thing is ridiculous, but it isn't the same as having an experience that then makes it impossible to deny.
Yeah, impossible to deny your experience. Yeah, the existence of something that you can't explain. That I say this all the time. If anybody listens to this show, they're sick of me talking about it. But Joseph Campbell having said, and I can never remember exactly what the quote was, but something to the fact that like taking in a story and taking it literally and not looking at the symbols is like eating the menu rather than the food it represents.
I like that.
I do too. And it's very indicative of what you're saying, that like you don't want to throw out the symbolism of religion because it clearly is touching upon something elemental and fundamental to this whole experience.
Yeah.
But it's been taken, they've eaten the menu rather than the symbolism, which maybe that's sustenance for some people. I mean, it clearly must be.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, obviously, I mean, none of us are in a position to be able to say that anyone else's experience is not valid.
Right.
But you know, the working theory, the theory and process that I've got going is that if there is a mainframe over everything kind of consciousness, and that consciousness, I mean, I'm led to believe that that consciousness created the universe as a place to play, a place to be embodied, a place to experience. Because if you're just a consciousness, it's like being a brain in a jar. You can think, but you can't do anything. And so, I know it's crazy, but it doesn't matter. Is it possible that the consciousness creates all of these things in order to have ways to embody itself? And so each of us is a piece of that thing in the way that every cell in your body is a piece of you. So one single blood cell is not me, but it's a piece of me. It definitely belongs to me. And I feel like that's what each of us is. And I think it's why all cultures throughout history have invented deities, because they sense they're a part of something bigger. We all sense we're a part of something bigger. And I also think that if that thing bigger is what created the world and the universe and the everything, it's why we get such a fucking kick out of creating things. It's because it is in our nature to do it. It is us emulating the higher consciousness, like a child emulating their parents in a way.
Yeah.
That whole child to parent thing, like that's a very common in religion. Like the God is the father or the mother, depending on your religious tradition. Anyway, I feel like there's something true about that, because I don't get nearly as big a kick out of anything as I do out of creating something and sharing it with people. Like that is just, to me, this is the best thing.
Yeah.
Satisfying thing.
I've had this notion that we are a story written, because I've come up with fiction, right? I know what it feels like to invent a thing that previously wasn't. drawing from experience, drawing from hopes and dreams, drawing from other people's whatever.
Right.
And you create a thing that isn't. Yeah. And that if the thing that is so central in our consciousness, the consciousness of the being that we are, the kind of ape that we are, is our capacity for story, that we make everything up. Mm-hmm. Like there's no, like Dan Brower didn't exist until your parents made him up, you know, mm-hmm. like, and you filled in the rest of the gaps. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no essential Dan Brower element in the universe that must have been. It was our story written. Mm-hmm. Same with me, same with my dog, same with all these things. Oh. You know, that if we are a story written, who's writing the story of the story, the scribe, you know, the person writing the story. So perhaps mm-hmm. this is like a endless unfolding, mm-hmm. an endless writing of story by the divine, whatever that is,
right?
Or that we just have this constant, one thing writes the other, one hand. What's that? Have you seen that artist drawing of the one hand drawing the other?
Yeah, it's M.C. Escher.
I've had that same image as a piece of writing, you know, not necessarily drawing, but like writing, one writing, bit of writing is creating the other. So I kind of feel sometimes like I'm some part of that, if that makes any sense.
It does. It does.
I quite like this, the image behind you of the man under muscular, is it muscular Jesus?
Yeah.
Which one is this one?
This was a painting I did in the 90s when I was trying to release myself from Catholicism.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's funny. It's sort of like, it's that superhero in the sky thing, the concept of gods being superheroes. Yeah. And then that's me. And I have a tattoo of the original sin I have a tattoo of the serpent. Yeah. And there's of course a little skull and, and then that's in the background is Adam and Eve by Dürer. Anyway, yeah, I did a bunch of very religious paintings during my agnostic atheist period because I was trying to sort of release myself from that, from the indoctrination, you know.
I've been thinking about talking to you and, you know, just anytime I'm looking forward to having one of these conversations with somebody, I see them in the world, if that makes sense. And just yesterday I was doing my laundry in this little town called Fairfax, which is like a sort of neo hippie enclave, not far from me. And I didn't have any quarters, walk across the street to go to an ATM in this fancy grocery store. And, on the pavement scrawled in multicolored chalk is go vegan. It just, which says so many things. It's like, you could just write or a cult. Whatever, you know, like, or vote Democrat, you know, whatever. It's all this, the idea of like certainty, right? That anyone is ever certain that there is a way to go. And veganism embodies that. And I'm not saying that vegans are wrong.
Right.
I'm not saying that I'm right. I'm just saying that like there is a, mm-hmm. there's something about certainty that really fucks with us because we really want it.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to be certain. I'd love to know for certain what happens.
Right.
When you're dead, or you know what was going on when you weren't existing,
right?
You know what my dog is thinking. I'd love to have all this certainty in my life.
That'd be awesome.
But the reality, wouldn't it be great?
Yeah.
But the reality is, I don't have any of that,
right?
You know, and that's why it's hard to. I went through a similar journey as you, where you reject the dogma and all the things, but you then calcify your way into this other kind of certainty. Uh-huh. Atheism is its own. Certainty, scientific reasoning can be its own certainty that's like undercuts the mystery of the thing. And it may often prevent you from just enjoying the fact that it's a pretty Monday.
Yeah. I agree. It's anything can become a religion. Any belief structure can become a religion.
Anything.
When you think this is the answer, this is the only way, that's a religion. And I was a vegan for 12 years, hardcore, and an animal rights activist. And while I still embrace a lot of those, a lot of that belief system, I'm not any longer a vegan. And it was the religious aspect of it that eventually made me fall away. yeah, just too much certainty. And the certainty that I had about atheism is the same thing. There's an enormous amount of freedom in uncertainty, in not having to be right all the fucking time.
Yeah.
You know, like that was something
huge weight
the longest time. And that's where confirmation bias comes back to bite us, is that we think we're right. And so when we find out anything new, we listen to it with the subconscious intention of applying it to our model. And if it doesn't apply, we don't believe it, or we don't remember it, or we don't. And it's like certain intellectual death. You will stop learning new things if you think you know everything. It's just the way it is. You have to, I don't know, if you really want to grow, I think in wisdom, you have to accept the potential of anything being true.
Yeah.
Or not.
Yeah. Well, one thing that's really interesting to me to watch, I spend a lot of time with and work with older people, like elderly. It's fair to say they're elderly.
Yeah.
And, the experience of having Google in their life is comparatively certainly newer to them than it is to me, because it's been around a much larger portion of my life than it has theirs. Yeah. But when they interact with Google, to ask Google or Siri or whatever a question, it's the same impulse I would imagine that made early man pray to his, God, why did this happen? But it's just the banality of the questions has become outrageously banal, instead of like, why did this happen? Like, what was Shirley Temple's first film? And, whatever, but it's the same reaching for this thing that, you want to get an answer for. But what's funny about Google is it gives you five different things immediately. Mm-hmm. And people, I've watched people do this all the time. They'll be like, well, why was Israel created and who did it? Right. And then the answers that come up, the one answer that supports the thing they already think becomes the doctrine.
Yeah.
That puzzle piece fits perfectly into the pre-existing notion, no matter whatever the four things otherwise contextually may have said, the thing that agrees and fits that confirmation bias and completes that puzzle is it's so tempting to do that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I watch it happen all the time. And it just seems like, to me, an ancient impulse.
It is.
Sort of like expressing itself in a modern context.
Yeah. It's funny. It's true. I never thought about that. But it's the default mode network, that part of our brain that constantly creates shortcuts because we can't re-understand everything about the world every second of every day. We have to imagine that we already understand all of this and something new has to be, and so as soon as we incorporate a belief, your default mode network will not let you override that unless you intentionally like really apply some effort to overriding that belief. And it's why people who have been watching Fox News for years are convinced that Democrats hate America. And nothing could be further than the truth, further from the truth. Nothing could be further from the truth. As Al Franken so brilliantly said, conservatives tend to love America the way children love their parents. They're always right, and anyone against their parents is wrong. Liberals tend to love America the way adults love each other. You want to help that person be their best self, but you don't think that they are infallible. And that, I think, is a brilliant assessment of the difference between the left and the right. And it's why Americans can seem to be unpatriotic. Liberals can seem to be unpatriotic to conservatives, because we don't back America in 100% of its behavior or of history. We're trying to make it better. We're not just praising it as the perfect thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Only in stories are villains ever 100% villainous and heroes 100% virtuous.
And that's not a great story. You know,
it's not a great story.
It's not a good way to write. No character in any story should be 100% good or 100% bad, because no human being is those things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's degrees of sympathetic, right? How sympathetic is that character?
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of charm in North America. You know, there's a lot of things that make it a sympathetic, villainous creature.
Right.
And the same with, you know, India or Mexico or any given place. There's no innocent culture, mm-hmm. for sure. No perfect innocent culture.
The world is a dimension of opposites. Everything has its opposite. Everything has a light and dark side.
That's right.
That's something Alan Watts taught me. He's not the first person to come up with it.
No.
It's basically Buddhist, I think.
Right. No, it's a fine concept that helps you contextualize the world around you.
Yeah.
Which is something that I think, and I'm glad you have that sense of knowing of your purpose and what you're supposed to do, because one thing I think you do well is to point out, to contextualize the world around you, to kind of make it funny. You know, like if you see me laughing, it's to, so you don't see me crying type of thing, you know, that your dark, funny humor, your dark, twisted humor is, it's a gift. And I like the way you do it with your cartoon. I like the bits you highlight with Peyote Cowboy, which I really quite like. I'm a regular reader. But your new venture, your newsletter, I think, is it a whole new take on this? Because you've been writing for a long time. I mean, your blog has been going on for many years. You've been talking about what's going on in your life, talking about the cartoons you've been drawing, things like that. But this other venture, it seems like a new avenue of expression for you.
Yeah.
And contextualizing the world around you, making fun of yourself. Like, what are you up to there?
Yeah, the newsletter project, which I'm calling The Naked Cartoonist, and I mean it metaphorically, it grew out of the fact that I was posting my cartoons, seven cartoons. Every week I'd do a blog post with all seven of the cartoons from that week from Bizarro. And I just couldn't, I like to write, and I've enjoyed writing since I was in high school, really. And so I would tend to, you know, instead of just saying this cartoon's about this, that cartoon's about that, I would get into these big long essays about one thing or another. Sometimes they were funny, sometimes philosophical, sometimes just complainy. Sometimes I was just bitching and moaning about my life. Other times, I mean, it's just all over the place. And I'm fully realizing that most of my readers are just going to go cartoon, 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 essay, cartoon, 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 boom, gone. You know, but some people were reading it, and some people would comment on them and say, I like your ideas. I like the way you write. I like this. I like that. Well, then the newspaper industry collapsed. The like physical newspaper industry. And what most people don't realize is that physical newspapers, when they became digital, they don't pay anywhere near as much for cartoons as they did when they were physical newspapers, because they had a monopoly. You couldn't sell your, like if Chicago had two or three newspapers, you could only sell your cartoon to one paper, and it became their thing. You wouldn't sell it to another newspaper. Well, online, you don't have that ability. You don't have a monopoly. You're not the only paper in the area available that has Bizarro. Everybody on the internet might have it or could have it. And so it's not worth as much. And so boom, as physical newspapers collapsed, so did cartoonists' income. And so I was faced within the last like 2 years, it's really been dominoes. We've known this has been coming for 20 years or so. But being a creative type, I didn't prepare for that. I just thought, well, I hope it doesn't happen before I retire. Anyway, it's starting to happen. So I had to find a way to bring in, to try to replace the income. Because I'm not one of those cartoonists who had a huge licensing. Like you don't see my characters on children's underwear.
Right.
Like you do with Garfield or Peanuts or whatever. You don't see it in, you know, it's like, it isn't a licensable, that kind of a cartoon. And so all I was really making was the money that newspapers were paying for it. And I had to split that with the company, the syndication company that distributed my work. So I did okay, but I didn't get rich, and I don't have a huge amount of money to retire on. So I had to find a way to replace that. And I wanted to do it with creativity. I wanted to do it in some way. I mean, selling fine art isn't going to do it. That's just too hard. So a lot of people like my writing. So I just decided to start a subscription-only newsletter. And once a week, I'll write an article. It takes anywhere from like 5 to 15 minutes to read, usually closer to 5, 6, 8 minutes, like that kind of thing. And then some extra stuff, some videos and photos and artwork and stuff from my life after the article's over. And you get this in your email once a week, and it costs you $5 a month. One article for $1.25. Come on, that's a pretty good deal. So, hey. anyway, and that was, yeah. And then I had to, but then I had to think more about my writing. When I was writing for the blog, it was free. Who cares? You don't like my writing? It isn't really organized well. It doesn't come around full circle. It doesn't make the same, whatever. It doesn't matter. I was just going for it. But it was a great way to learn. It was like a nursery for writing. Because I would write all kinds of stuff. For years and years, I was doing this. Once a week, I was writing all of this stuff and then seeing how, and then bouncing it off the public and seeing how it hit them. So little by little, I kind of learned how to do that. So now I'm doing it more in a more conscious way. But I'm still trying to channel, because I really believe there's two ways to create. You can either invent shit in your mind and try to form it into a thing, or you can let it happen. You can let it flow. You can open that door and just let that stuff come through. And then you refine and you correct and you improve and you, those kinds of things. I'm not saying that it comes out perfectly, but there's a, and that can be true of graphic arts too. I can think of an image and create it, which is what you do in commercial art. Somebody says, I want a drawing of this. Then you just think of it in your mind and you create it. But when you let the muse tell you what to paint or draw, totally different thing. It's like I look at a blank canvas or a blank piece of paper, and I wait until something occurs to me, and then I start to draw that, or paint it. And then when that's finished, and that's how I did these things, these big oil paintings that I had in my house, which look nothing like my Bizarro cartoons. Those were like I think the first thing that came to me was this character. It's like I just want to roll myself up into a fetal ball on top of a blanket and see what that and so I like I had my wife take some Polaroid snapshots of me like that. Yeah. 35, 40, 75 years ago. I don't remember. That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And then I painted from these, you see these blurry little photographs, and then I would look at it and go, what's next? Oh, someone's standing on me. Who is it? What is it? Jesus. What does Jesus look like? Oh, Jesus has a muscle builder. It's like it was just come to me, a piece at a time. And then at the end of it, I look at it and I go, what does this mean? Oh, and then I can start, after that, I can actually start to thread a story through it and say, oh, I think this is what this means to me. And it should mean something different to everybody. I think that's an important aspect of art too.
Yeah.
If everybody knows exactly what your painting means, that's not a successful piece of art. It should be a little something different for everybody. But anyway, that's what my writing has become. It's just like just having fun with it. And some of it's philosophical because there's always a little humor and there's always a little philosophy because I'm kind of a funny philosopher. That's just always been my profile and my mental profile in a way. So I think a lot. I'm a seeker. I'm a thinker. I think about the world and why it's the way it is. And psychology and emotions and history and all this stuff. But then it also, a lot of it just seems ridiculous and funny to me. And so anyway, some of it's humor with a little philosophy, some of it's philosophical with a little humor, but it's always kind of those two things. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. You've got a good knack for deconstructing. You're a natural deconstructionist.
No kidding, man. I am. I have a friend who actually is a philosopher. He's older than I am. And half the time when I start explaining something, he's one of these guys, he's like such a great philosopher that he rarely talks, right? Because he knows that he doesn't know anything. Like that's truism when you know you don't know. And that's my friend Walter. And every now and then when I start explaining something, Walter will smile and say, ever the deconstructionist.
Yeah.
Because I tend to deconstruct everything.
Everything.
Well, the reason, yeah. See, this goes back to evolution. It's like I always bring everything back to evolution.
Yeah.
Somehow. I can explain all human behavior through evolution.
It's a nice lens. It's a good lens.
It is.
And that might be the best you can ever hope for, is which lens does your eye fit in? You know, like those things at the doc, at the optometrist office where they click it. Like, oh, there I am. Now I can see. And that's, you know, your lens is this deconstructionist lens.
Yeah.
Some people are.
I don't know what to say.
Yeah. You know, everybody's got their way to see it. But I'm glad you're doing it, man. I like the newsletter. I like your writing. I've had a chance to read a good bit of what you're up to. And I don't know. I obviously want to encourage it.
Well, I would like to say for your listeners who haven't read your work, you're a phenomenal writer. I envy your writing, and I'm not kissing your ass here. I mean it. I wish I was as good a writer as you are. And for any of you listeners out there, if you've not read his work, you need to.
Thanks, pal.
His book, The Moron at the End of This Book, is priceless. It's really one of my favorite books ever. I went on about it on my blog.
I know. And that was really kind of you. You have a really interesting readership. I've actually met two of your readers in person.
Yeah.
Who live in the Bay Area. And very different people. The thing they have in common is that they can they also have kind of a deconstructionist sort of bent.
Yeah.
That can see the world in this way that's like picking apart the absurdity and finding something to love in it, and you know, having creative reasons to weep themselves to sleep.
I think that's a good way to put it. I think I've gotten a sense of my readership over the years just by the thousands and thousands of comments. But of course, I don't know all of them. Mm-hmm. But I know my work does tend to attract, and this is true of anybody really, it tends to attract like-minded people, people who like to think outside the box. They think around, I often say it's for people who like to think around corners. Mm-hmm. Not everything's a direct line. Not everything's right or wrong. There's like everything is on a scale, and there's a lot of different ways to see any position. And most of it is ridiculous and funny if you look at it hard enough. It's like, this life isn't as serious a matter as we tend to want to make it. It's kind of a parking lot carnival of idiocy. my whole life certainly is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm going to put up links and stuff, but so there's bizarro.com.
Bizarro.com is my main site. And from there, you can see my cartoons, and you can also see my Naked Cartoonist newsletter. There's a sample available for free, but then you have to pay to get the actual. But like I say, it's $5 a month.
It's totally worth it. Totally worth it. If you would let me, I'd pay you, but you gave me a free one, so I'm grateful.
Well, you're a good pal, so of course. Yeah,
likewise. Well, let me ask you this before we sign off. You've already said so much like heartfelt and profound shit in this past hour that we've been talking, but if you had like, is there someone you would like to send a message to, a certain person, a sentiment to hand out to the world, a joke that you've heard recently? Do you want to make an obscene noise? Is there something that you'd like to do before we sign off?
You caught me off guard.
That's what I like.
I can't think of anything. An hour from now, I'll think of something I should have said.
Yes.
But as of now.
Perfect. You know. What a thing to say. Well, I'm glad you're out there saying the shit that you are saying and doing it in the way that you do it. I think it's very, it's compelling and it's fun. And I'm glad that you are a little bit more your face forward and you're letting people in on your world, not just the world of Bizarro, but it's becoming more personal. People are getting to know you.
Yeah.
Which I think people quite like.
I like doing that. And I think that is the essence to all valuable creative efforts, is that you have to expose yourself to some degree. And you worry. It's like, if I tell people this, they'll think this about me. No, what they'll see, if I tell something, you know, if I confess something, say something bad about myself or be honest with myself, everyone will think that I'm this terrible person. No, they'll recognize themselves in you and they'll relate. That's what real art, like good art. And I mean that with music, writing, anything. It reveals something about the creators, the person who's creating, its human nature. And that's what draws people to it. It's like, oh, I see myself in there. This isn't just some, they're not just blowing smoke up my ass. They're showing me their ass. And I've got one too. Please don't quote me.
That's going in.
Not my most eloquent quote, but that's what came out.
Right. I mean, yeah, that's, you know, to find the blind spots in your character, you've got to pay attention to others, you know, and not just be critical of others, but be able to see yourself.
Yeah.
I just talked to a buddy recently about the value of creativity and imagination as it relates to empathy, because that's the bedrock of empathy is imagination.
Mm.
And to me, that's the best way to use imagination is to be empathetic and to be able to put yourself in someone else's shoes and see their plight and understand it. You know, God, if that was happening to me, would I be nice right now? No, I'd be whatever.
Yeah.
You know, so that if your art can do that, fantastic.
Yeah, I recently heard somebody say that you can look at any person in the world and say, if I was that person, I would behave as they do. I'd believe what they believe and I would do what they're doing. Mm-hmm. It's just we are a product of who we are and where we came from, and there's just no denying that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's no reason to, well, whatever.
Yeah. What are you gonna fight about? You're fighting with yourself.
It's an interesting ride. Enjoy the ride.
Yeah, man. Enjoy the ride.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, Andrew. It always is. I'm glad you're a person in my life.
Likewise, man.
Yo tengo un burroso carro que no le gusta trabajar. Y si lo ponen a cargar, se tira al suelo a descansar. Mas este burro es un campeón, si es que se pone a enamorar. Y si una burra ve pasar, para las orejas y a rebuznar. Ay, ay, ay. Ay, ay, ay.
Ruso carrón. Well, hello there. It's me again. Did you enjoy that episode? I sure did. If you've got any interest in supporting this show, a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify would be nice. If you haven't subscribed, please do so. Oh, and be sure to visit mtp.dog. That's mtp.dog to learn more about our guests. Thanks for listening and for sticking around so long after the guests said goodbye.
Para las orejas ya rebuznar. Ay, ay, ay. Ay, ay, ay. Cuidado, el burro se soltó. Y a una burra enamoró.